Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Sea Control, a podcast series brought to you by the Centre for International Maritime Security. As always, I'm the host of the Asia-Pacific leg, Natalie Sambi, an analyst at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute and president of the ACT chapter of the Australian Institute of International Affairs. Today, I'm bringing the episode to you from Washington, D.C., and I'm very excited to introduce my guest. My first one from my America series is Associate Fellow with the Southeast Asia Chair at the Centre for Strategic and International Studies, Ms. Feng Wen. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Natalie.
So today we'll be talking about Vietnam's evolving strategic and foreign policies. But before we get into that, we'll be back after this short break.
SIMSAC brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And like the United States, SIMSAC is and always will be free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership, which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. However, admin, special projects, software, events, and prizes do cost money. There is a new option to make a voluntary monthly donation at the bottom of every SIMSAC article. No matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SIMSAC is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today.
Hi and welcome back. So today we'll be talking about one of Southeast Asia's more interesting countries in the face of a changing strategic environment with more assertive Chinese behavior in areas like the South China Sea. What Vietnam's been doing has been catching many an eye both in China and in the United States as well. So today to discuss the ways in which Vietnam has been responding to some of the security challenges is Ms. Feng Wen. Thank you again. So before we get into the topic, I'd like to introduce you to our listeners. Let's just start a little bit about how you got into security studies and a little bit about your career.
So thank you, Natalie, for having me on this podcast. As Natalie mentioned, I'm the Associate Fellow with the Southeast Asia Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I got into this role by starting to work as a researcher for CSS back in 2012. At the time, I was studying Asian Affairs at American University. And when I came on board with CSS, it was around the time of normalization of relations between U.S. and Burma or Myanmar. And, of course, Myanmar was opening at the time, so it was sort of my formative experience with Southeast Asia. Of course, I was born and grew up in Vietnam, so there's also that. But really, the formative experience for me with Southeast Asia was with Myanmar's opening. And it has really captivated my curiosity and my interest ever since. And I've been with CSS for over 3 years now, and things in Southeast Asia are just getting more and more interesting, and that's why I'm still here. And a lot of my work focuses on U.S. foreign policy toward countries in Southeast Asia, China's diplomacy with these countries, as well as domestic politics and reforms in a lot of the countries of mainland Southeast Asia.
Excellent. And you've also been contributing to CSIS's AMTI, that's the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative as well.
Yes.
Excellent. And so moving to the main subject of our podcast today, looking at Vietnam's evolving strategic and foreign policies, as I mentioned earlier in the intro, there have been lots of developments in the relationships with the United States and with China, with other Southeast Asian states. And it seems that a lot of these developments have been prompted by developments in the maritime space itself. To take one, for example, a major one at that, in May last year, there was a bilateral crisis that was sparked when there was the state-owned China National Offshore Oil Company, which placed an oil rig some 17 nautical miles within the EEZ of Vietnam. After that, there was a diplomatic crisis that was sparked in the standoff between both sides. Can you walk us a little bit through the main features of that incident, just to give us an idea of actually how acute that crisis was?
Sure. So in early May of 2014, out of the blue, China deployed a state-owned oil drilling rig to waters claimed by Vietnam in the South China Sea, and Vietnam was really caught surprised by this incident, by the development. Of course, before that, China-Vietnam relations had been very cordial. These are two countries that had fought one another for millennia, for centuries, so conflicts are not unusual. But the ruling Vietnamese Communist Party had thought for a long time that as long as they maintain party-to-party ties with Beijing and they engaged instead of confronting China, things would go well for the relationship and that the conflict in the South China Sea could be managed. But China's actions just sent shock waves across Hanoi, and a lot of Vietnam's policymakers didn't really know how to respond to this because it just wasn't part of the game, so to speak, between the two governments and the two ruling parties. And Vietnam and China have long-standing party-to-party ties and backdoor channels that can be used to resolve the conflict. But what happened was Xi Jinping reportedly turned down any outreach efforts by the Vietnamese government to resolve the issue, and Vietnam was really at its wit's end. And domestically, this development has turned into a challenge, a political challenge for the government as well. People started taking to the streets to protest China's actions, and the government did little to prevent it, if not to say, you know, they turned a blind eye on these protests.
So those what you're protests, saying is protests aren't usual in that kind of fashion?
It's not usual at all. The government traditionally wanted to prevent protests, especially anti-China protests, because a lot of the people who showed up at these protests were also anti-government and pro-democracy activists. So the government didn't want to see any of that, but when the oil rig happened, they turned a blind eye, and more people turned out to protest the deployment of the oil rig. And especially, you had a standoff between Chinese and Vietnamese forces at sea during those weeks as well. So things really got more tense over the course of the next few months, I think. And the government tried different ways. They tried reaching out to China. They tried to turn a blind eye on domestic protests to sort of send a message to China. And the Prime Minister of Vietnam spoke at an international forum where he had some strong words to say about China's actions at the time. And none of those policies worked. It was the lowest point between China and Vietnam in decades. So that really was a turning point in Hanoi's strategic thinking about China. And the shift is that Hanoi realized it doesn't matter what it does or does not do, China will still go ahead with its ambitions in the South China Sea, and Vietnam's attitude really doesn't change the game in the South China Sea that Beijing has been playing. But at the same time, you have to realize that Vietnam has really stood up during the incident, more so than China had expected. As people know, Vietnam is not a U.S. ally. Relations have been improving for the past few years, but it's not a U.S. ally. It doesn't have a treaty alliances with any big major powers. And Vietnam's capacity is no match for China. So Beijing, when it undertook this action, expected Vietnam to not contest it very much, but Vietnam has reacted differently. Diplomatically, Vietnam reached out to international partners and garnered support from ASEAN, also from the United States at the time. And Vietnam also continue to send Coast Guard vessels to the area and withstood Chinese forces for weeks. And the Chinese really didn't expect any of that. So in its own way, Vietnam tried to resolve the situation without much cooperation from China. But even as relations resume after that with high-level visits between China and Vietnam, the tension was there, the suspicion was there, if not, became higher. So there you have it. After that, I think Vietnam realized that it has to change the game because that is not the game that China was playing. And I think after the incident, you sort of see a shift in Vietnam's policy in the South China Sea. They realize that they have to take a page out of China's playbook if they're going to play this game for the long haul.
And what sort of page is that? Like, what was Vietnam's position after this oil rig incident?
Yes. So in December 2014, Vietnam filed a statement with their permanent court of arbitration in The Hague, which is handling the arbitration between China and the Philippines on the South China Sea. And the statement was a way for Vietnam to ask the court to take into account its interests when handling the case between China and the Philippines. In many ways, people said that it was Vietnam's way to get into this arbitration through the back door, to have one foot in and see how the ruling turns out to be and then decide whether it wants to put the other foot in as well or whether it wants out of this game or how to proceed next. But then it started to learn to play all cards with China, and after that, I think you see an uptick in relations with other international partners, especially the United States and Japan. Much more so with the United States, because people really didn't expect to see a surge in cooperation, military-to-military cooperation between Washington and Hanoi this year, because Vietnam is going through a sensitive period of political transition, so people didn't expect that. But military-to-military cooperation still proceeded, to the surprise of many. And, of course, Japan has been stepping up its assistance of Vietnam. So you can see that Hanoi is now playing all cards, and it tries to really take a page out of China's playbook to play China.
Sure. Speaking of that surge between relations between the Vietnam and China, you mentioned military-military cooperation. Are there other elements of that surging relationship?
With the United States?
With the United States.
Yes. So oftentimes people seem to think that the South China Sea is really the only shared interest between Vietnam and the United States. I think the South China Sea dispute plays a big role, but there are other strategic interests that the two countries share as well. One, Vietnam is part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, which the U.S. has been leading for the past few years. So Vietnam is a main TPP partners, and I think the United States is playing the long game in Vietnam. It sees the potential, it sees their opportunities there, but there are practical things that the two can work on, and the U.S. wants Vietnam to become a stable partner in Southeast Asia, because much of the rebalance for the U.S. in Southeast Asia has focused on finding stable partners. So I think the U.S. hopes Vietnam to play that role in the long run to the best of its ability. So there's the Trans-Pacific Partnership. There are regional interests. The United States and Vietnam have been holding a dialogue on the Asia-Pacific for a few years now, and the idea is for the two governments to share their perspectives on the Asia-Pacific region and allow Vietnam to become comfortable with what the United States is doing in this region and have a stake in developments across the region as well, because Vietnam, it has been a rising, regional power, but it's still a newer member of ASEAN, and I think the United States wants to see Vietnam play a bigger role and see their region not through Hanoi's lens, but through ASEAN's lens as well. So there are overlapping interests besides just the South China Sea. But to return to military cooperation, Coast Guard cooperation, bilateral Coast Guard cooperation has proceeded quite fast over the past year. The United States is assisting Vietnam in building a state-of-the-art Coast Guard facility in central Vietnam overlooking the South China Sea, where the Vietnamese can train their Coast Guard personnel and can monitor developments on the coast. Last year, in October, the United States partially lifted its ban on the sale of lethal weapons to Vietnam. Of course, the ban had been there since the end of the war because the two countries fought each other during the war. So the ban had been there since after the war, and it was a major impediment in the relationship because Vietnam saw that as a lack of trust, causing a lack of trust between the two sides. So having it removed really helped with Hanoi's feeling comfortable with the United States. And now the two sign a joint vision statements on defense relations, I think in May of this year. And that really took the military to military relationship to the next level. And now, you know, you're really talking about maritime security cooperation, joint peacekeeping training. You have building their defense trade component of the relationship. But also, the two sides are stepping up cooperation to address remaining war consequences, such as UXOs and Agent Orange in Vietnam. So you have a wide range of cooperation, but it's really forward-looking in that the United States is now actively helping Vietnam build up its Coast Guard. Vietnam has requested 5 to 6 Coast Guard patrol vessels from the United States, and it is slated to receive a major chunk of U.S. maritime assistance to Southeast Asia over the next few years. And I hope that sort of covers the wide range of military-to-military cooperations between these two countries, which, when you look at it, are former foes. And just 20 years ago, there was nothing there, and now they're cooperating on a wide range of issues.
Mm. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, it seems as though the trajectory of U.S.-Vietnamese relations is quite positive. But I just wanted us to dig a little bit deeper. Obviously, I don't think it's going to be that simple. As you mentioned earlier, the US and Vietnam are not just centered on their interests in the security space, they have other interests as well. Similarly, Vietnam and China, they may be they may experience some friction at the moment in the security relationship, but they have other relationships as well, if not trade and economic. What I wanted to ask you is, to what extent does Vietnam's desire to have a healthy economic and trade relationship with China going to affect its potential growth within the relationship with the United States? What can you say about that kind of triangular relationship then?
Yes, I think that's a very important issue. One of the biggest debates being played out in Hanoi at the time is how far and how fast Vietnam should go with the U.S. militarily. But China continues to be the number one foreign policy priority for Vietnam. China is there. It's the next door neighbor, is Vietnam's biggest trading partner, and it is always going to be in the South China Sea. Mm. So China continues to be the number one foreign policy priority for Vietnam. The question is, Vietnam needs to find a way to just stand up to China, send a message to China, but at the same time keep the relationship stable. Because at the end of the day, if you look at the U.S.-Vietnam relationship, the U.S. is not going to assist Vietnam, let's say, in a scenario of conflict. There are limits to the U.S.-Vietnam relationship, so it really comes down to engaging all partners, especially the United States, but at the same time keep China comfortable and keep their China relationship stable for the long haul.
You talked about the anti-Chinese sentiment at the height of the oil rig crisis. You know, looking now at December 2015, what's the level of anti-Chinese sentiment either in the public or in the party at the moment? Is there a difference?
It has been growing in the public, I shall say. And Vietnam's leadership is facing quite a challenge in dealing with China because 5 years ago, Chinese actions weren't as pronounced, and it was easier to address these issues through party-to-party channels. But now, with China's actions and with the public's access to information, to social media, it's becoming harder for the government to make the case that we are doing the best of our abilities to handle this challenge while keeping relations with China cordial and stable, which is necessary for the country's development. And of course, if they look across the region, across the body of waters, that's the South China Sea, the Vietnamese public sees Manila taking Beijing to court over the South China Sea. So that, to them, was sort of a model for how to handle the situation with China. And so the government has been doing, I have to say, quite a formidable job at handling China while moving ahead with the United States, Japan, and sending a strong message that Vietnam is not going to back down the South China Sea. But how to handle the domestic audience will be a real challenge because a lot of what happens in Hanoi is not well understood. The strategic context of China-Vietnam relations is not well understood by the Vietnamese domestic audience. So that will be one big challenge. But interestingly, while the public sentiment toward China is extremely low, the public sentiment toward the United States is just extremely high. And so people feel like Vietnam should be a lot closer to the United States than it currently is. I think if you look at the latest Pew Global Attitude Survey, 97% of Vietnamese feel favorable toward the United States.
97?
Yes. And they want to see the United States play a bigger security role in the region. So there you have it. The public would like to see the government move closer, much closer to the United States, and to stand up more to China than it currently is doing. So that will be a real challenge as Vietnamese become wealthier and more informed and more educated, and they want a bigger say in the country's policy issues.
I mean, there are a lot of other economic developments occurring in other Southeast Asian nations, not just in Vietnam. And as you and I know, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN as we call them, have been trying to move towards this concept of an economic community by December 2015, in other words, this month. And as we hurtle towards that, and they're looking to integrate more and reduce tariffs and trade barriers, you know, there's also ongoing discussion that I've heard at Dialogues this year about, you know, growing closer in the security realm as well. What I want to ask, it's obvious that some of these major strategic developments where the South China Sea and China's behavior is concerned has prompted change and evolution within Vietnam to reach out to partners like the United States and Japan. Have those strategic developments prompted an evolution within Vietnam to look towards its Southeast Asian neighbors for security purposes or ASEAN as a whole? How does Vietnam look at those as those for security?
ASEAN is a very important factor in Vietnam's foreign policy, and it will become even more important as you know, we go forward. This year, under Malaysia's chairmanship, Malaysia is another claimant in the South China Sea dispute, of course. Malaysia also has quite cordial relations with China. But this year, under its chairmanship, it has done a decent job in helping build consensus within ASEAN countries on the South China Sea issue. So Malaysia has been affected by China's actions as well. China's harassment of Malaysian survey ships in the South China Sea, which is not talked about a lot, but that is something they do face. So things have taken place in quite an unexpected manner. I know that many people in Washington would like to see ASEAN be more forceful on the South China Sea dispute and, you know, issue stronger statements about China. But I think this year Malaysia has done a very decent job at building consensus within ASEAN and messaging to non-claimants within ASEAN why they ought to say something on what's happening. So their statement that ASEAN Defense Minister issued earlier this year when they met in Kuala Lumpur, I believe, in April, was the strongest statement that ASEAN has ever made on the Sovereignty issue. Four paragraphs in the joint statement of the defense ministers, that's the longest you've ever seen in any statements that ASEAN issued. But part of it was for international consumption as well. So the debate between people who watch ASEAN right now is, will Malaysia's posture continue past 2015 when it's no longer the chairman of ASEAN? Malaysia, of course, has felt more and more threatened by China's actions, but will it continue to play this role when its chairmanship is over and Laos takes on the chairmanship in 2016? So you will have to see on the Malaysia front. Vietnam and Malaysia, of course, have stepped up military cooperation and intelligence sharing between regional commands in the two countries. Vietnam has stepped up relations with the Philippines, another claimant in the South China Sea dispute. And this year, the two countries signed a strategic partnership to boost military-to-military exchanges. So that's one major development. But what will come out of that strategic partnership, I think, remains to be seen, because Vietnam needs to be careful. As I mentioned, the party wants to send a message to China, but not too strong of a message as to turn off Beijing. And the Philippines has really upset China by taking it to court over this issue. So I think Vietnam wants to be careful about what it will do with the Philippines and how much support it should be seen giving to the Philippines. Indonesia, I think, has been and will play an important role on the South China Sea issue. And what we're seeing is that Jakarta's threat perceptions toward China has been rising. And that's, I would say, a positive signal, because it shows us that even as people are concerned that under Jokowi, President Jokowi, Indonesia will look inward, it's looking at their regional environments now, and it's realizing that what happens to other countries in the South China Sea is of interest to Indonesia. Even though Indonesia is not a claimant, it is not immune to what happens in the South China Sea. So I think that will be very interesting. And I should point out that Indonesia and Vietnam also have a strategic partnership that most people don't focus on or don't know much about, because there wasn't a lot of attention paid to it as with their Vietnam-Philippines strategic partnership. So I think those are Vietnam's key maritime partnerships in ASEAN. But at the same time, of course, the country cares very much about relations with neighboring Cambodia and Laos. Vietnam often says that the rebalance won't be complete unless Washington pays just as much attention to Cambodia and Laos, where China has been making a lot of advances and its footprint has been growing, as to, let's say, Vietnam and the Philippines. So then if you look at it, Vietnam is surrounded by all sides, by threats coming out of China, coming from China. So that's the strategic environment that they're facing. And that's why ASEAN is much more important to Vietnam than people would like to think.
And of course, I mean, a lot of these Southeast Asian states have to balance between dividing energy towards the regional body and a lot of their domestic issues as well. Looking forward into 2016, to give our listeners a sense of the kinds of challenges that each of these ASEAN states will be undergoing, I just wanted you to pick perhaps, you know, maybe your top three challenges that states, particularly Vietnam and others, will be experiencing, to give a sense of actually what the region will be undergoing in future.
One of not so much challenges but uncertainties facing Southeast Asia as a whole is what happens in the Philippines in 2016. Under President Aquino, the Philippines has prospered and it has forged a foreign policy path that many people believed was more credible than in the past. And next year, President Aquino will be stepping down because, according to the Philippine Constitution, he can't stay on for another term. Of course, Foreign Minister Albert de Rosario will also be stepping down, and he has really shepherded Philippine foreign policy over the past 5 years. So what would the Philippines do with regards to China and the South China Sea post Aquino? I think we have to watch it carefully, especially because the ruling of the case between China and the Philippines is expected sometimes in June next year, as early as June, but we know that it's coming sometime next year. So we have to watch that carefully. And whether the next administration in Manila will pay just as much attention to this or will they pursue the policies of the previous administration remains to be seen. And that matters because despite progress made in U.S.-Philippine relations as part of the U.S. rebalance to Southeast Asia, a lot of the gains in recent years haven't been consolidated. You have a bilateral defense deal called the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, which the two sides signed in April of last year, and it's still being stuck in the constitutional courts in Manila over whether it's constitutional or whether it amounts to a bilateral treaty that requires Senate ratification and deliberations. So that remains to be seen. And if the Philippines is weak, then that is really a weak link in U.S. policy towards Southeast Asia as a whole and to the rebalance to the region. I think so. Okay, so that's the Philippines. But if you look across the region, there are other uncertainties. In Malaysia, where Prime Minister Najib Razak has been facing political pressure over his involvement with a state investment fund called One Malaysia Development and its sort of mismanagement of government funds. So Najib is quite important for U.S. Malaysia in recent years, and under Najib, the two countries forged a comprehensive partnership, and U.S. Malaysia defense cooperation has expanded and has been strengthened under his leadership. It remains to be seen whether he will stay or whether he will forced to step down within the next few years in the short term. That would have a lot of implications to Malaysia's political stability and U.S.-Malaysia defense cooperation, as well as Malaysia's participation in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement as well. And if you look at Thailand, neighboring Thailand, you can't really predict what will happen there. The country will, it looks like the country will remain under military rule for some time to come. But how long would that be, and what does it mean for U.S.-Thai relations, the treaty alliance that the two countries have, if Washington continues to condemn their military rule of the country and Thailand continues to inch closer to China tactically, at least at the moment, but that will change Thailand's strategic outlook down the road. So you have a lot of uncertainties, but I would say what to watch for, one of the key things that we have to watch for is the building of the ASEAN community. And I don't think that has received its fair share of attention here in Washington, where we tend to look at ASEAN through a security lens or as part of U.S. Strategy toward dealing with China or, you know, through whichever lens we prefer. If you talk to leaders in Southeast Asia, if you talk to the people who have to run policies in these countries, what they're most concerned about is how they feed their peoples, how to help people improve their livelihoods, and not so much how do we improve U.S. relations with the region. I mean, so that's one thing. And Southeast Asia is a huge market. But at the same time, that means, you know, there is more people that you need to feed and find jobs for. So the U.S. really needs to look at this region and understand the day-to-day concerns of the peoples and the regional governments and really talk to them about things that they care about and not so much things that Washington cares about and wants to see happen without regard to what they really care about. So how the ASEAN economic community plays out and whether that will change the region's outlook, that remains to be seen. I think people in Washington will start to watch that more closely. And of course, one big unknown is Myanmar, which has been one of the U.S. policy priorities in the region, I would say. Washington really went all in to support Myanmar's opening and reform process and elections. And now you have had an election. You have the results. Opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi is expected to take office. Well, not her, but her party, the National League for Democracy, is expected to take office in April. And that means good news for the relationship between the United States and Myanmar, because that is an outcome many people here had long wanted to see. But where the country goes next is really anybody's guess at this point. How the military will respond in the next phase of the reform process, because they possess enough of the resources to make life for Aung San Suu Kyi really hard, as well as any cooperation between the U.S. and Myanmar. So if you look at it, Myanmar is located between India and China, and it's the largest country on the Southeast Asian landmass. So if you don't have stability there, a lot of the security issues, non-traditional security threats, will flow out of the country to neighboring countries, to China, to India, to Thailand, the Bay of Bengal. If you look at it, you know, stability in Myanmar is vital to security of the region, to stability of the region. So that will be a big development to watch next year, I think.
Fascinating. I think we could do a podcast on each one of the 10 Southeast Asian countries. Look, I think we'll have to check in with you again in 2016 to see how some of these developments have unfolded. But until then, thank you very much for your comprehensive look at Vietnam's evolving foreign and strategic policies in light of a changing strategic environment. Hope you can join us again.
Thank you.
And to all our listeners, don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. You can get all of our past podcasts as well. And don't forget to follow us at simsec.org or at Twitter at CIMSEC. Have a wonderful holiday season, and we'll catch you again in 2016. Thank you.